Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking once again with Dr. Jean-Pierre Isbaut. He's an historian, a doctoral professor at Fielding Graduate University in Santa Barbara. He has published all kinds of works, The Origins of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, including two bestsellers, The Biblical World and In the Footsteps of Jesus. And today I'm talking with him about another National Geographic book called Archaeology of the Bible, The Greatest Discoveries from Genesis to the Roman Era. Dr. Jean-Pierre, welcome to LifeQuest.
Thanks, Dwight. Thanks for having me.
Why should our listeners be interested in biblical archaeology?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm always fascinated to see that when new discoveries are made in either Israel or any other of the lands that are featured in the Bible, they command headlines.
Yes.
I find that very striking because for many of us, my colleagues, archaeology is a very specific science. It's laborsome. It's hard work. I mean, there are many digs that I cover in the book that have been going on for many, many years. But then, the discoveries made, such as the tremendously important discovery of the synagogue in Magdala on the Sea of Galilee. Mm-hmm. And there are headlines all over the world, and it's featured on CNN and the news, and that tells me that even in our very sophisticated, advanced society in the 21st century, people are still fascinated by what the Bible may represent, whether it's because you are Jewish or Christian and a believer, or whether you recognize the enduring role of the Bible, the biblical stories on our Western civilization, in the realm of ethics, in the realm of what it represents for who we are. And I think that's why people are so interested in what these discoveries may reveal. And the other aspect is that there's always this sense of, is the Bible history?
Right.
Are the stories in the Bible, are they true? Did that really happen? And as I write in a new book I'm working on right now, which will come out next year, it's the wrong question to ask.
Yes.
It's taking a 21st century question to a first century issue. And that's because people in antiquity didn't really care whether an event happened or not. For them, there was a very different definition of truth. For them, a story was important if it carried meaning, if it carried something that could enrich their lives, that could help them to understand mm-hmm. what's going on in their own experience. For us, we don't recognize that. We think
right.
something is important only if we can read about it in the newspaper and we can see the footage, news. It was very different in antiquity, and so people had a different criterion for what makes a story important or not.
I had an interview along these lines recently. I mean, it wasn't an interview, it was a conversation, and the man said, I like it when the preacher talks about the New Testament, but the Old Testament, it just seems to be a different God and that sort of thing. And I tried to explain just what you were saying here, how that the message was that God cared, and he was very patient, regardless of how the details seem to come across the centuries and the millennia to us. It's also, this subject does have some political ramifications, doesn't it, in the Middle Eastern part of the world? Who was there first? Who has a right to this and that and the other?
Absolutely, and that's a difficult question to address. Certainly for me as an American archaeologist an historian who tries to sort of look at these things from an objective perspective, it gets a little more difficult, particularly in Israel of today, where we have ongoing excavations right now in the area which is referred to as the City of David in the old city of Jerusalem. And ongoing excavations by some archaeologists have resulted in various objects, such as boule, which are clay seals, that seem to refer to the Davidic kingdom, the kingdom of David,
right,
which is a very important subject for many reasons.
Yeah.
There is a large group of scholars who argue that the kingdom of David may have never happened, that it was a legendary concept developed later in the 7th century for largely propaganda purposes in order to suggest that there had always been a strong monarchy in these lands as early as the 10th century, which may or may not have happened. Of course, in today's climate, it's very important for some archaeologists to demonstrate that there has always been a Jewish presence in the old city so as to support current policies by the Netanyahu government to, abrogate and settle Jewish communities in land that is Palestinian. So it's, for a modern archaeologist, it's incredibly difficult to address that. And in my book, I try to address it from multiple perspectives and to say, look, in the end, we have to look at it strictly through the perspective of science. We cannot be swayed by either religious or political motives. We just, at the end of the day, we are scientists, and we just have to do our best job to determine whether this this data can tell us something of value or not.
And we, from our more modern perspective, when we talk about palaces, when we talk about a monarchy, as you just did, we have a certain vision of what that means. We think of gold thrones, and we think of elaborate buildings and all that. And sometimes we're brought down to a different perspective as archaeology reveals what type of society people lived in back then.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's really what I try to do in the book is to say, look, there are many stories in the Bible that may or may not have direct historical value, but what we can say, apart from the important moral value that these stories have, is that they originated in a very specific place and time. You know, the story of Abraham carries tremendous richness from the Mesopotamian and the Babylonian period.
Mm-hmm.
The story of Joseph clearly originated in an Egyptian milieu. For the story of Joseph itself is very similar to stories that were circulating in the Egypt of his day. Moving on, when you talk about the story of the settlement, we don't really talk anymore of the conquest, Joshua's conquest of the Promised Land. We really talk more of a settlement process. But there, the information that you see clearly relates to life in the late Bronze, early Iron Age. And so there is tremendously interesting material to be gleaned from these stories, quite a part of the historicity of the characters that feature in these stories. But clearly, these accounts give us tremendous important information about the time that dovetails with the archaeological findings in this area. You know, the reference to chariots, for example, is a clear one. And we know that chariots were invented by the Hittites, introduced by the Hittites in the Bronze Age, and finally percolated down into Egypt of the second intermediate period. So when we hear of Ramses II marshaling his chariots to go after the Israelites as they ride across the Red Sea, we think, well, yeah, you know, that's actually true. That is truly when, in the beginning of the early new, part of the New Kingdom, that's when Pharaoh started to use horse-drawn chariots.
Right.
So those things are really fascinating. You know, where the Bible and science intersect, that's really what the book is about.
Folks, if you just tuned in, I'm talking with Dr. Jean-Pierre Isbaut. He has written another National Geographic published book called Archaeology of the Bible, The Greatest Discoveries from Genesis to the Roman Era. And I wanted to tell our listeners, Professor, that this is such a fascinating book, not just with its literary content, but the wonderful photographs and the pictures of things through the ages describing the events of Scripture, but also the archaeological discoveries that tell us something about these people. And I was just thinking of what you were saying, Joseph, Egypt. We keep forgetting that much of the Bible, Old Testament, is written after people had been a slave people for 400 years.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And of course, much of the Bible casts itself in retrospect.
Yes.
The development of the Hebrew Scripture, or what Christians call the Old Testament, is a fascinating story in itself. And of course, these stories must have been circulating for quite some time. But I think scholarship at this point, modern scholarship, agrees that the first pieces of what we would recognize as the canon of Hebrew Scripture really started to come together in the 7th century B.C. The Babylonian exile gave a tremendous impetus for scribes and scholars to say, okay, you know, we're in captivity, but let's put it to good use, and let's start to continue this work. And so it's during and after the exile that you see the first two divisions of Hebrew Scripture, the Law, the Torah, and the Kevim, the prophets, come together, so that when we enter the time of Jesus, for example, it's fascinating to see that when Jesus talks about the Bible, he talks about the Law and the Prophets, Law and the Prophets. That's how you read it in the Gospels. And it's only another 300 years later that the third division of Hebrew Scripture, which is the writings, are added, and at that point, as far as Judaism is concerned, the Bible is complete. And it's fascinating that around the same time, we're talking 3rd, 4th century A.D., or in the Common Era, as we say today, that the Christian canon of the New Testament is finalized as well. So even though they develop on different tracks, you can see that in the 4th century, both the canon of the Old Testament, Hebrew Scripture, and New Testament is coming together. So it's that in itself is a fascinating story. And as these scribes put together the stories that had been communicated to them over the centuries, they looked at history through that perspective. So give you one fascinating example. We often hear about camels. For example, Joseph in Genesis is brought down from Canaan to Egypt by Ishmaelites, a very interesting term in itself, on a caravan of camels, because the scribes in the 7th century, 6th century B.C., could not imagine anyone traveling anywhere
without a camel.
Without a camel. Well, we now know that camels didn't really enter into the picture until the 8th century.
I see.
And so camels didn't exist. Certainly not as beasts of burden in the time when we think the story of Joseph is set.
Right.
So those are wonderful things. It's sort of that rear-view mirror effect that you can see.
You've divided the book into these various chapters, the archaeology of the patriarchs, of the Exodus, of the kingdom of Israel, then in the Second Temple period, and then you're getting down to the life of Jesus. So there are archaeological finds and descriptions coming through a much more recent time. I mean, recent, it's 2,000 years ago, but still, on the life of Jesus.
Absolutely. In fact, I just got back from the Middle East late last night.
I see.
I got a little delayed because of the pilot strike that was going on in Egypt, and I was flying on that particular German airline. So I got to spend 3 days in Vienna, not necessarily a bad place to be.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
But it did delay. But I came back. I spent quite some time in Jordan and Israel, indeed, as you say, to look at some of the radius discoveries. And there's two things I would love to tell your
please.
Listeners about, which are very, very exciting things that I saw there. First, Jordan. And I have to plug this country because tourism to the Middle East, outside of Israel, of course, has really ran dry. Egypt, Jordan, because of the war that's raging there. But I just had a wonderful time in Jordan. It's a very welcoming country. It's not as developed, perhaps, as you would expect to be compared to Israel. But wonderful, wonderful excavations are going on there. The fort of Machaerus, for example, where we know that John the Baptist was beheaded, imprisoned and beheaded. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful, beautiful location. It took me a while. I had a little SUV to go up the hills. It took me about an hour from the Dead Sea to get there. But it's a beautiful location. And going forward, Bethany by the Jordan, which is the Jordanian side of the Jordan, where archaeologists have uncovered several very early churches, going back to the Constantinian era, which would suggest that from a very early time, the east bank of the Jordan was revered as the location where John the Baptist baptized Jesus. Going forward, one place I definitely wanted to see was Pella, which is not very well known to most of your listeners, I think, but Pella is the place where the Jerusalem group of Christians fled to after the outbreak of the Jewish War in 66, and that's where sort of the Palestinian group of Christians, the remnants of the original movement that was based in Jerusalem, fled to. And I just really wanted to see it because colleagues of mine had told about how wonderful it is, and I was there. I was the only person there. There was not a soul around, but it was a very haunting place, beautiful place. But what I really wanted to share with you is the fact that we have some very exciting news coming out of digs in Israel. Mm-hmm. I got a private tour of the excavations going on under the Kishle, which is an old Ottoman prison close to the citadel of David. For your listeners who have been to Jerusalem, they will know that when you enter the Jaffa Gate, you turn right. That's the large museum complex called Citadel of David. Underneath, Amit Reim has been digging and coming up with some astonishing discoveries, including a large swimming pool.
Really?
And you might say, well, what's so exciting about a swimming pool? Well, we know that when King Herod the Great built a large palace in Jerusalem, he had an Olympic-sized swimming pool built there, which was quite novel for its time.
Right.
We know from Josephus and other sources that it was huge. It had steps leading into it, and I was there. I saw the plaster of the pool. I saw the steps leading into what would have been the large swimming pool. And why is that important? It is because we don't quite know where Jesus was tried by Pilate. And there are two places. There is the Praetorium, as John refers to it, which would have been the place where the most important, the leading Roman official would sit, most likely the palace of King Herod, or that of the Antonia Fortress, where his troops were based. I've been going back and forth between these two possibilities, but certainly the idea that it was right there where Amit is digging right now, and that would have been the place of Jesus' trial. One reason why we're starting to think that that may have been the place of the trial is because the earliest traditions of the Via Dolorosa, the route that Jesus took on the way to the cross, ran through that area. And we never quite understood why that is. And so now that we've seen, I was there last week, and I saw the stones. I even saw the tunnels which King Herod built. He was always very much aware that he was not a very popular guy. He ran a very oppressive police state. And so wherever he went, he built escape tunnels in the case of a rebellion.
I see.
He and his family could get away. And I was there. I saw the tunnel, and it's actually referred to in Josephus, the books of Josephus.
Uh-huh.
Moving, moving time to think, well, this is perhaps where Jesus was tried.
And finally, you have a chapter on the archaeology of early Christianity, and that would be what, the first century?
Yeah, so the first century, second century, that's when things get a little bit more clear, because in the book I'm writing right now, I always make the point that when people say, well, you know, there's really not much historical proof that Jesus existed, mm-hmm. my answer is, well, what do you expect? Polaroid, snapshot,
yes, right.
Birth certificate. Once again, you know, we're bringing a 21st century mindset to a first century issue.
Right.
How would a rural figure in the first century in an area like Galilee, how would he be remembered? There would be no stone, there would be no sculpture, because obviously Judaism forbade the depiction of living beings.
Yes.
What we do know is oral traditions, you know. And I always make the comparison of Socrates. You know, we all know Socrates, Greek philosopher.
Right.
We only know about him through documents and accounts and descriptions written at least 30, 40, 50 years later by his pupil. But nobody would, at this point, disagree that Socrates was a historical figure.
That's true.
This is what happened. So it gets things get a little easier when you move into the later first century, because we have Josephus, this historian, and you have more tangible things that are happening. Paul, for example, is moving in a milieu in Asia Minor in Greece that is very well attested, where you have a lot of people who are literate, who can record things. So yeah, things become a lot more tangible when we move into the first century, and there's some fascinating conclusions to draw from that as well.
Again, the book is a National Geographic book. It's called Archaeology of the Bible, The Greatest Discoveries from Genesis to the Roman Era. Dr. Jean-Pierre is about. By the way, folks, I got to tell you, this is a very colorful book, wonderful illustrations, photographs, things like that, in the appendix in the back, the times, how does that relate to the scripture. How can our listeners get a copy of this book?
Well, they can certainly go to the National Geographic Books website. There's always Amazon.com.
Yes.
And in your local bookstore. I must do a plug for our local bookstores, because we don't want them to.
Right.
Go away. Here. And so if you go to your local bookstore, even if they may not have it right then, I've seen it in many stores, but if they can order it for you. And so there are many ways to get the book.
Jean-Pierre, thank you once again for being a part of our program here on LifeQuest.
Right, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.